Before we talk to our first guest, the author of one of the most successful movies of all time, here's a relevant song from the Paul Harris Band.
Down in Florida decides to scuba dive. He's got his mask and flippers on, but he won't come back alive. Are you ready? Are you ready for this? Are you ready to lose your feet? You're going out, but you're coming back with a shark tooth in your seat. Another shark bites your butt. Another shark bites your butt. And another arm gone, and another leg gone. Another shark bites your butt. Hey, he's gonna get you too. Another shark bites your butt. You hear it every day on the news. Another shark attack. Somebody goes to scuba dive and ends up in a snack. When you're diving, when you're snorkeling, you better watch out because you might dive in to feed the fish and end up in a jar. Another shark bites your butt. Another shark bites your butt. And another arm gone, and another leg gone. Another shark bites your butt, yeah. Hey, he's gonna get you too. Another shark bites your butt.
There is the Paul Harris Band here on the Big 550 KTRS. A perfect intro to my guest, who joins me on the phone now, the author of the screenplay of the movie about sharks and one of the most successful screenplays of all time. Here's the man who wrote Jaws, Carl Gottlieb. Hello, Carl.
Good morning, or good afternoon, as the case may be.
Well, still morning here.
Good day, then.
And welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
First of all, I got to tell you, we're going to talk about your book, The Jaws Log, which has just been re-released in its 25th anniversary edition. I read it when you first came out with it in the mid-70s, and this is a terrific piece of writing about making a movie. So I congratulate you on that. Now, I got to ask, with all the shark stories we've had in the last couple of weeks, listening to the officials in these various towns saying, oh, no, no, we're not going to close down the beaches, we can't do that, did you flash back to Murray Hamilton in your mind?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the old, the sharks are out there, but we've got a tourist trade, and we make more money from the tourists because sharks don't buy popcorn. So let's invite the tourists.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if they're getting eaten up. As long as they come in here and buy stuff in our stores, that's what the Murray Hamilton character, the mayor in Jaws, was like. And that's what these people still are like 25 years later.
And also, I mean, it's a shocking similarity that when the movie came out in the summer of 1975, we had a big shark attack here on the West Coast. An actual great white bit somebody in San Diego, and they accused the publicist of planning that shark attack because it happened simultaneously with the release of the movie and put us on the cover of Time magazine that month. And here we are again. The book is coming out. The DVD came out last summer of
yep.
Jaws, and Jaws 2 DVDs being reissued. And here's my book, The Jaws Log. And there's the sharks again. I don't know how the publicists manage to get these things going just in time for the book.
But never doubt the power of a Hollywood publicist is a lesson we've learned here today.
They're sharks themselves.
The shark in the movie, when you were making the movie, was called Bruce. Where'd that come from?
The Steven Spielberg's entertainment lawyer who crafted his contract for the job was named Bruce Raymer, and
uh-huh.
he was a shark, so we called the shark Bruce. Bruce Raymer is still in practice and still is proud of his title.
He is a shark, though?
He is a shark. He's a benevolent shark, and he only bites for his clients, but a shark nonetheless.
Now, he's still in business, but when you were making the movie, Bruce the shark, the mechanical shark, wasn't in business a lot, was he?
If Bruce the shark had been paid by the hour, he would have made a nickel for that movie.
What was the problem?
It was a piece of engineering that had never been attempted before. Nowadays, they've got Tyrannosaurus Rexes and Raptors running back and forth across a stream thanks to, computer graphics, CGI, computer graphics interface. But in those days, there were no computer graphics, so if you wanted a monster, you had to build one, and you had to build one who could function in real time and real space, which meant a 25-foot great white shark that had to swim left to right, right to left, up and down, dive, come up, bite people. It was an amazing piece of technology, and it was built and tested in freshwater, and then they took it to Martha's Vineyard and sank it in salt water. And as you know, the ocean eats everything.
Mm-hmm.
Salt water was corrosive, and all the electrical contacts fizzled and shorted out and had to be replaced by pneumatic controls.
Oh.
So you can imagine, you know, if there's one set of controls that makes the eyes roll and another set of controls that makes the mouth go up and down and yet another set of controls that makes the body of the shark wiggle from side to side,
mm-hmm.
each one of those controls means two pneumatic hoses, air in, air out, and a guy standing there with his hand on the throttle coordinating so that when the head turns, the eyes roll and the mouth opens, and that means, you know, three men, six pneumatic lines, you know, 40 feet of hose, and trying to get it all coordinated.
And trying to get all that coordinated when things are going wrong can't be easy.
It can be impossible.
Yeah, so what happens when you're making a movie about a shark and the shark don't work? What do you do?
Well, you start, as we did when we made Jaws, we decided let's not show the shark that much in the first half of the movie for dramatic reasons, and that made a great deal of sense. Stephen and I both were very familiar with a film called The Thing, which is about a creature from outer space that's thawed out in the Arctic station and poses a great threat to everybody. And you don't see the creature for about half the movie, but you hear the radioactive beep, 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 beep sound whenever he gets close. And it was a terrifying little black and white, you know, horror movie that we both liked. So we said, you know, we could do that like The Thing. We could have evidence of the shark's, terrible strength. We could show that wonderful opening sequence that Stephen designed with Chrissy being eaten by the shark and being pulled this way and that. One of the, I think, great openings of any horror film.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody in the audience goes, ooh, what is this thing? What is this thing? What is this thing? And then finally, when they're ready for it, you go, it's this.
So you made that conscious decision before you found out you were having shark problems, or as a result of the problems with the mechanical shark?
Almost a combination. We were starting the rewrite. There was a couple of early shark scenes that needed to be moved. And then once we learned that the shark wasn't going to be working anyway, no matter what we wrote, we decided to, you know what, let's just defer the shark until we need it.
You know, you talk about the opening scene with Chrissy, the girl going nude, bathing, and she gets eaten at sea by the shark and all that. And that is a terrifying scene. But the scene that's even more terrifying to me, without seeing the shark, is the two guys on the pier.
Yes.
They've got this big hunk, what is it, the roast?
Yes, one of them has stolen his wife's roast, and he's going to use it as bait, catch the shark for the bounty. So they attach like a big logger's chain to a big hook, and they put the roast on it, and the shark takes the bait and starts to run with it, and little, you know, sturdy little pier that they're sitting on just gets pulled into the ocean.
And one of the guys gets pulled into the ocean,
yeah,
along with it, and then the shark turns around, and now the pier is chasing the guy, and you know the shark is pulling that pier. That is a heart-pounding moment in that movie.
It is, The poor actors who played that part had to, you know, there's a moment there where they scramble like crazy to get out of the water, and the pier is pitched at kind of a nightmare angle, and they're climbing, and come on, come on. And it was not stuntmen, it was the actors, and they had little bloody fingernails when that was over.
And that scene of his boots trying to climb up that broken-down pier to get out of the water, come on, don't look back, Tony, don't look back!
Don't look back, indeed.
Oh, man. Now, when you're working with a Steven Spielberg, who, of course, was a small S Spielberg, as opposed to the capital S-P-I-E-L-B-E-R-G that he is now, everything's capitals these days, but in those days he wasn't yet Steven Spielberg, but you're working with him on a movie like this, do the two of you create a scene like that together, or did you write down on a piece of paper, this is what happens, and he said, thank you, Carl, and then he goes and shoots it?
It was a combination of those things. Some of the more visual moments had been already created by Steve and a production designer named Joe Alves, who drew storyboards, kind of like big comic strips with photos of the action.
Mm-hmm.
And some moments were visualized by me sitting quietly in the living room typing, Stephen and I shared a house in Martha's Vineyard that summer, so when he got home from work, we'd sit down and have dinner together. We had a housekeeper who made dinner, and we'd just sit and talk about the movie and where the script was going and what we were doing. It's not the usual way to make a movie. Usually you start a movie with a completed script.
Yeah.
But there were revisions in progress, and I joined the production quite late. So I think I started about 10 days before the movie commenced shooting. So I had to catch up on all this, you know, script, throw out a bunch of stuff that we didn't think was going to work, and attack the story, and not only just write dialogue, but write action as well. So it's the best collaboration of my life. It's where the writer and the director, you know, put their heads together, using you know, their own skills, and then kind of overlapping. There's some physical action that started in my head. There's some dialogue that started in Stephen's head, and there's dialogue that the actors improvised.
So you're writing each night, coming up with stuff, and would there be times when you would write something in the evening, and then daybreak would come, and okay, now Stephen's taking the camera down, and we're going to shoot what we wrote last night?
We had a few of those. It was scary. There'd be a production secretary and the typist would be standing by. This was before, just at the early days of Xerox machines.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd get the pages. Of course, Dick Zanuck and David Brown, who were the producers, were the ultimate authority, so they'd have to bless the pages before they went out. So, you know, I finished writing at 2 or 3 in the morning. Zanuck or Brown would get a look at them. Stephen would say, okay, good, we're going to shoot this today. And then they'd rush to get them down to the crew and have them mimeographed and distributed so everybody knew what it was we were shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just where, you know.
Right. Show up down there. We'll have paper for you, but just show up on the beach. We'll be there in a few hours.
Yeah. Dress warm. And those of you who are going in the water, you know, have your wetsuits on.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Carl Gottlieb, who wrote the screenplay for the classic movie Jaws, one of the all-timers, a top 10 movie in everybody's book. And he wrote about it in a book called The Jaws Log, which has just been re-released in paperback for the 25th anniversary edition. It is really a must-read for anybody who's into movies or particularly into this movie. You're talking about the actors having to dress warm. I have been in the water off the coast of New England, and even on the hottest day of August, you can't spend a lot of time in that water. These actors weren't filming in the summer. Some of them were shooting stuff in the springtime, weren't they?
Yes, and we started shooting on May 2nd, 1974.
Oh, man.
And continued until September 15th or 30th, the following autumn.
And you appear in the movie as an actor, right?
Yes, yeah. I have very good billing because it was a big part at one time. Harry Meadows, the publisher of the paper, me and Murray Hamilton are the principal villains,
mm-hmm.
the businessmen who want to keep the town going.
Right.
And of course, as a writer, I realize, geez, Murray's a wonderful actor. The mayor is carrying the weight of the plot here. This publisher guy is kind of extraneous.
Oh, no, but that's me. I have to cut me out of the movie.
Yes, the saddest thing I've ever done as a writer is cut my actor character out of the film, take him out of a scene here, take him out of a scene there.
Mm-hmm.
And in one case, we even filmed a scene that I was in which we discover Ben Gardner's boat. That's the moment where the head appears at night.
Yes.
Well, when we first wrote that scene, it was a daytime scene, and for some reason, the publisher of the newspaper was on the boat as well as Roy Scheider.
Why wouldn't he? Because the screenwriter is the newspaper publisher, and he wants to be on that boat.
That's what you would think. So we filmed it, and in the course of filming it, it was one of our first days on the water, and I fell off the boat. I went head first into the briny deep. Everything had to stop. They had to rescue me. I was, you know, treading water so furiously, I was probably waist high out of the water. My hat hardly ever got wet, and I went in head first. And and of course, you know, Dreyfus had never piloted a boat in his life. He was just pretending to steer the boat. The marine advisor was crouched underneath the sight lines, piloting the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard me go over, and he had the good sense to turn the ignition off so that the propellers didn't chew me up.
Yep.
And I'm bobbing around and going, I'm okay, just get me the ladder. And then I'm thinking, wait, there's sharks in these waters. Not big, you know, enormous sharks that we write about in the movie, but they're sharks.
Mm-hmm.
there's crabs and there's cuda. Anyway, I got out safe and sound. They dried me off. And then we decided, you know, this scene might be better at night with just Roy and Ricky, just two principals.
Now, is that
so
because...
We wrote the nighttime dinner scene and then the scene where they go cut open the shark and then look for the other one.
Which is a classic, but be honest now, Carl. Did you cut the scene out because you didn't want to go back out on that water? You fell in once and you thought, you know what, if I cut this out, I don't have to do that again.
Well, I was young and game. I was ready to, you know, to drive around in high seas and, you know, try to act and steer the boat at the same time. I was ready to be Captain's Courageous, Men Against the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
But it just didn't work out plot-wise. And it was a sad moment, and my big scene came out.
And so when they shot the scene at night, was that scene with Dreyfus going underwater and the floating head comes out of the hole in the boat after he finds the shark tooth? You know, anybody who's seen the movie is now visualizing this in their head. That's one of the great scary popping head moments of all cinema history. When he shot that, was that done under the water of the Atlantic Ocean?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, the whole scene was shot on the lake at Universal's back lot, with a lot of mist and fog to conceal the amusement park behind us,
mm-hmm.
Hollywood Freeway. And then when they did the underwater stuff, that was in a tank. And it wasn't satisfactory for Steven the first time around. It worked okay, but it wasn't the moment that he had been looking for. And in the Jaws log, there's a recollection of that moment where Steven said, "I've got to do it again." And the studio said, "No, you know, film's finished. You know, it's a good scene. Leave it alone." He says, no, it can be better." And the studio said, "No, we're finished." And Steven said, I'll pay for it myself. I just have to reshoot it." So he got a little skeleton crew without any sound, and you know, just put together a couple of pieces of wood to make up the bottom of the boat, and went out to the editor's house in Van Nuys, California, and she had a little house, a little two-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath house with a little tiny swimming pool, kind of just a place to get wet in the summer. And they put tarpaulin over the swimming pool, grabbed a gallon of milk out of her refrigerator, poured it in the water to give it kind of a milky, diffuse look.
Wow.
Put the head in the boat, put the diver in the Ricky's wetsuit, and shot the scene again in a swimming pool in the water. And that swimming pool take is the one that's in the movie.
So the guy we see in the movie Jaws discovering that head popping out of the bottom of Ben Gardner's boat, that's not Richard Dreyfuss?
Well, spiritually it is.
But physically it's not.
It might be an ex-Navy SEAL named Frank Sparks. It might be.
When you're writing a screenplay like this and working on a movie and updating it and changing it as you go along, do you have to be conscious of not putting in too many moments like that? I mean, that's a great scary moment, and the moment where the shark comes out onto the bow of the boat and Roy Scheider says that great line, "We're going to need a bigger boat," and you know, the one we talked about earlier on the pier and all that sort of stuff. Do you have to be conscious of not putting too many of those in? Is it possible to overwhelm an audience?
Well, you know, if it's really good, if they're really good moments, I don't think you can overwhelm an audience. I mean, first of all, those moments are very hard to come by. And Howard Hawks, the great American film director, once said, if you have five of them in a movie, you've got a hit. Five genuine audience, you know, moments.
Mm-hmm.
That the entire audience becomes one person.
Right.
And, you know, I suppose if you were a director, a writer, producer, and you wanted to, and you could do 10 of those, then you would go for that. And if you think about, you know, the movies that we love over the years, they all have, you know, as many moments as the filmmakers can stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you can't have too much good. You got plenty of bad, and we do these days.
Yeah,
because those moments when they don't work, it's very obvious that you're trying for them. You know, you're trying for the big moment.
Right.
The funny dialogue line. And if it doesn't work, then it's just hanging out there like a like a turkey. Everybody's got egg on their face.
Yeah, and you don't get Ben Gardner's head coming out of there. You get a turkey moment instead.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't get that shock moment there.
It's Steven Seagal. With all respect, he's a great film artist.
Yes, he is. Sure. Talking with Carl Gottlieb, the Jaws log is out in the 25th anniversary edition now, looking back on one of the great movies of all time. Tell me how these guys got the roles. How did Richard Dreyfuss get the movie, and Roy Scheider and Robert Shaw? Perfect casting.
Roy was the first guy Stephen cast. He had seen him in the 7-Ups, and he wanted a fish out of water, you should excuse the expression, but yep. The tough New York cop who's retired to the quietness of the island because he wants to get away from the routine horrors of Manhattan patrol work. And so Roy was set pretty well early on. Then the part of Matt Hooper kept changing because the script kept changing. It had gone through a couple of rewrites, and in the book he's kind of a handsome surfer preppy guy who has an affair with the chief's wife, which we didn't think we wanted him to do, because if he was going to kill the shark, he had to be pure of heart.
Mm-hmm.
So having eliminated the marital infidelity angle, we decided we didn't need an actor like Jan Michael Vincent, I think, who was being considered for the part. We needed somebody with more intelligence and spunkiness and wit. And Richard came to mind, and we had both knew his work. I had worked with Richard a couple of times on other projects in improvisational theater. And he had already turned down the picture, based on an earlier script. And I said, wait a second, does Ricky know I'm doing this rewrite? And Stephen said, I don't think so. So I called my wife in Los Angeles and said, where is Dreyfuss right now, this minute? She said, I'll call you back. And she said, he's in New York. He's pushing a movie called Dirty Kravitz. He's on tour. So we called the hotel in New York, got a hold of Richard, said, you've got to come up and talk to us about this movie. It's not the same script you read. So he came up to the hotel in Boston, walked in the door, dressed like Hooper. He had the hat and the little beard and the wire-rimmed glasses, and Stephen and I looked at him and said, don't change a thing. You're already in your wardrobe. And then we talked him into it, and, of course, once he saw how the script was going and how different it would be from the preceding scripts that he had rejected, he went for it. And then, of course, it was in that little conversation in the room where we found the joke where he crushes the styrofoam cup. It was a room service at the Holiday Inn in Boston consisted of styrofoam cups, and we had one in the room, and somebody crushed it, and somebody else said, wouldn't it be good if the effete guy crushed the cup while the big macho Robert Shaw guy crushed a beer can, and there we had a joke.
Yeah.
And, on that kind of note, Richard said, I'm in, not realizing how deeply he was in.
He has said that he didn't really enjoy making this movie because of all the trouble with the shark and the filming at sea. Was that true at the time? Was it evident to everybody that he was not having a good time?
Well, it's hard to say that anyone was having a good time. It was a long and difficult shoot. It was a time when even a picture like Jaws, which had a large budget, not a huge budget by contemporary standards, we were on a tough location. Martha's Vineyard is a beautiful vacation spot, but we're not vacationing. We're getting up at 5 in the morning and going to work and coming back, so you don't get to appreciate any of the beauty of the island.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're working on the water, as they did for the last 40 or 50 days of the shoot, you're out there, cold, wet, sunshine, too hot, too cold.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, if you've said 30 seconds worth of dialogue or gotten 20 seconds worth of shark action, that's a good day in terms of the film, but it's a 14-hour drain on the emotions and the waiting. It's like combat. The long moments of fear and anticipation and waiting, and then 30 seconds of terror, and then back to waiting while the adrenaline rush comes down.
Right, Right. Plus, you've got a mechanical shark that's not working that well, and all the boats involved. I'm guessing you had problems with the boats, too.
We had problems with the boats. We had problems with the people who drove the boats. And that's the boats that we controlled. Theoretically, you were supposed to be all alone on an open ocean. Well, that's a very popular, you know, yachting destination, Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, yeah.
Found. And there's a picture in my book that's captioned, "Thank you very much, you're in the shot." That's a picture of the orca at sea with the, you know, the actors, you know, waiting for the shark. And then there's this full-rigged schooner just sailing right by, you know, people on the deck drinking beer.
Yep.
Enjoying themselves. And if the schooner's on the horizon, you got to, you know, either send a chase boat, you know, send a speed boat roaring across, you know, 6 miles of water to say, "Could you turn around, please? We're making a movie." You know, it's
hard to control people on the ocean, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. I mean, everybody's Captain Kidd. Everybody's Captain Hornblower.
Yeah. I'm looking at that picture right now. You've got a whole bunch of pictures from the movie, including a great shot of Steven Spielberg in Bruce the Shark's mouth.
Yeah, relax.
I guess during a period when the shark was either working or not working, but everybody was taking a break, and so he laid down for it, or maybe it was just a publicity shot, but it's a great shot. And it reminds me a lot of that scene we were talking about earlier where the shark first comes out of the water behind Roy Scheider while he's chumming off the back of the orca. And he says that famous line, "You're going to need a bigger boat." Is that one of those times where when you have the shark not working and the boat not working, you just can't do anything?
Yeah. I mean, and if you had heard the original production soundtrack, you would be hearing, you know, clank, shh, whish, clank, boom, boom. There's all the mechanisms. "All right, take, bring it up on pipe two. No, not two, four, do four. All right, get the thing going." And then the shark finally does its mouth opening, and actually took Roy a little by surprise. It wasn't supposed to work at that moment. It was, you know, he was resetting himself. He had just thrown the chum in and figured that would be cut. And just then the shark did what it was supposed to, you know, rise up, open its mouth. And he jumped legitimately. And then he ad-libbed that line, "We're going to need a bigger boat." I wish I could say I wrote it.
Oh.
But Roy, being totally in character, and I take credit for creating a character that he could live with,
right,
and absorb, and although he was in totally in character, and he says, "You, we're going to need a bigger boat."
So that is genuine fear on his face, or at least surprise,
yeah,
when that thing comes up. Yeah,
absolutely.
See, this is the kind of stuff I love, and you tell these kind of stories in the book. It's the Jaws log. Carl Gottlieb, who wrote the book, wrote the screenplay for the movie. You told us how Scheider got the part. You told us how Dreyfuss got the part. How did Robert Shaw become a part of the movie?
Robert Shaw became a part of the movie as a second choice, and the actor who would have been our first choice was unavailable because he had tax problems with the U.S., and that actor was Sterling Hayden, who was a marvelous, craggy character actor, probably best remembered by film buffs for playing in Stanley Kubrick's film about, World War III.
Dr. Strangelove?
Dr. Strangelove. And he played the corrupt police captain in Godfather. But Sterling Hayden grew up on the sea. He was an actual sailor. He was a dory fisherman on the Grand Banks. He made his name and got his face in the papers by sailing a schooner almost single-handed from Tahiti to Boston. And the Boston Paramount sales rep saw him and said, "Here's a guy who looks real good with his shirt off. He should be in movies." He took a screen test. He became an actor. They put him in westerns mostly. He fought in World War II. Serious fighting. He parachuted behind the lines with the OSS in Yugoslavia. Came back to Hollywood. He was the character. But sadly, he could not do the part. Every penny he would have made as an actor would have gone to the government. Declined to.
And so when you have a disappointment like that, how do you get Robert Shaw?
You look around, who's rugged, who's available.
Who's craggy?
Yeah, who's craggy. And the beauty of Robert Shaw is that we had seen him in, both Stephen and I realized that he was the only James Bond villain who was a credible threat. You know, the other villains in all the Bond films were kind of cartoon guys.
Mm-hmm.
Old Gert Frobe as Goldfinger. The villains were always kind of, you know, turkeys. But in From Russia with Love, here was Shaw, and you got a sense that, ooh, this guy could give Sean Connery some trouble. You know, this guy's almost as good as Bond. So he had a real physical presence that we had seen. And that was the key to that character. He had to be a physically commanding guy and a guy who could be obsessed. And Shaw had those characteristics.
Was the character Quint based on a real-life shark killer? Is there such a guy?
Well, there's two guys. There is a shark killer out in Long Island named Frank Mundus, who wrote a book called Fishing for Sharks. And he kind of pioneered the practice. And he was, you know, kind of a salty old guy. And then there was a guy on Martha's Vineyard, a foul-mouthed old man who was the shellfish constable on the island. And he, too, like Sterling Hayden, Craig Kingsbury, was a sailor all his life. He had run away from prep school back in the 20s and had gone to sea and had, you know, been in bar fights and sailors' adventures and sailed all up and down the East Coast, long line fishing for sharks and for swordfish and harpoon fishing. He was a real salty character, and he had a great way with words. So I'd sit with him with a tape recorder and tape his dialogue, just tape him as he talked. As, you know, we'd go, Craig, tell us about summer tourists. And he'd go on, hey, they'd be sorry their mothers never met their fathers. Great lines like that. And a lot of his dialogue found its way into the character of Quint. He's kind of a compendium of craggy old guys I've known with salty language.
And where did the famous Robert Shaw scene where he's talking about his experience on the USS Indianapolis when it goes down and most of the men are eaten by sharks, where did that dialogue come from?
That came from Shaw himself. We were nervous about that speech. Everybody knew it was going to be a big moment in the movie because it was the last long dialogue scene before the action starts and then doesn't stop. We used to call the scene just before the battle, Mother. It was, you know, kind of like in a war movie where the guys have one last quiet moment in the trenches before they go over the top and it's mm-hmm. all shooting and killing after that. That was the kind of scene it was. And Stephen asked all his friends to try to write that dialogue. Paul Schrader did a pass at that dialogue. John Milius did a pass at the dialogue. I wrote it 3 or 4 times. Howard Sackler, who was the writer who preceded me on the script, who doesn't receive screen credit because not much of his work survives, he was the one who introduced that scene. It's not in the novel. And as we approached it, you know, there was like handfuls of dialogue. There's, you know, reams of dialogue from all over being dictated on the phone, being, you know, faxed. So ultimately, one night, Robert Shaw comes over to dinner at the house that Spielberg and I shared. Zanuck was there, Richard Dreyfuss, Verna Fields, the editor. We were talking about other parts of the movie. We were discussing his scene. And he came in, he says, I think I've got that scene whipped. I'd like to do something like this. And he took this paper out of his pocket and read the speech pretty much the way you hear it in the movie. And we all looked at each other and said, my God, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it was shot. Now, John Milius, who was Stephen's friend and still is very often credited with that speech. And that always annoys me a little because he really didn't write the speech. But he takes credit for it, and Stephen occasionally supports him in these, you know, making-of documentaries. And my point always is, who do you believe, the guy who was there, me, and tells you he didn't write the speech, or the guy who wasn't there and tells you he did? So it was essentially Robert Shaw's work. Now, Robert Shaw, by the way, was a playwright and a novelist. He's published. He wrote The Man in the Glass Booth, a very powerful Broadway West End play. novel called The Hiding Place. he was a wordsmith. He wasn't just, you know, an actor who said other people's words. So he was certainly capable of writing it, and he did.
Well, I'm glad that he got the credit here today and does in your book, too, because that is a pretty powerful piece of writing there, as is much of what you you write throughout the book, and or rather throughout the screenplay. And when you're taking somebody else's work, Peter Benchley wrote the novel, and you and other writers worked on the screenplay, and you wrote the finished version along with Spielberg that we saw on the screen. Do you worry, gee, I wonder what Benchley thinks about this?
We did, you know, we always were a little wondering about, you know, how Peter would go for it. And there was some bad blood between Peter and Stephen because both were giving interviews to the press without having met, without having discussed the project and the way it was going. And it took and the press, with the miraculous timing that the papers are sometimes capable of, printed, you know, the conflicting articles, and, you know, one being dismissive of the other, so that when Peter got to the set, he was going to play a part in the movie. He does play the part of a TV anchor talking to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So when Peter got to the set, to the Vineyard, everybody was quite tense. But it turns out, we all like to play poker. We all enjoyed a glass of scotch. We all, you know, were, you know, aware of the problems of making this movie. And Peter slid into the scene and fit in pretty comfortably and realized that everybody was doing their best work, struggling to bring something to the screen that was inspired by his book. So he kind of relaxed, and then once the film opened, he was perfectly happy to be the author.
Yeah, I can't imagine how you could be unhappy having it say, you know, based on the book by Peter Benchley, and you can't be unhappy having it written by Carl Gottlieb. When you finally saw the finished version of this, did you know in your heart, we've got a hit movie here?
It felt awfully like a hit. I had been to a sneak preview of another movie I had worked in as an actor, MASH.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the movie of MASH.
You played Ugly John, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And
I remember the sneak preview of MASH, how the audience reacted, and I'd never seen an audience react like that because they were just so surprised and delighted. So when we went down to Lakewood in southern Los Angeles County for the preview of Jaws, and the audience went up for grabs. I mean, there was a buzz that was deafening. And people were coming out of the theater, you know, with that happy, you know, burble. It sounds almost like a rushing river. You know, everybody's talking about the movie.
Right.
And we had heard the screams, and we had seen the audience jump when the head comes up. And when an audience physically moves in their seats because of something that they're just watching on the screen, that's the sign that you've got them hooked.
Mm-hmm. Unless they're completely bored and they're shuffling around waiting to get out of there.
Oh, yeah. If they're walkouts, that's a different thing altogether.
So you knew you had something there. And, yeah, of course, it has become one of the biggest movies of all time and has made hundreds of millions of dollars. Do you mind if I ask, Carl, how much did you get paid?
For me, to actually make the movie, I made, I think, $8,000 as a writer and $7,000 as an actor, or vice versa. Anyway, I took home $15,600 for
$15,600.
Yep.
And you take taxes out of that, and I'm sure the state of Massachusetts wanted to hear from you.
Not only did I pay taxes out of that, 10 years later I got a letter from the state of Massachusetts asking me to pay taxes on my per diem, which had been given to me in cash on the set.
Oh, my
hotel
God.
And food. They wanted to collect a piece of that.
Uh-huh.
I ignored them.
Wow.
But the book provided a very decent return because of the number of copies it sold. To this day, it's still the best-selling book about the making of a motion picture ever written. It ran through 17 printings and sold about 2 million copies.
And it's been
I had a decent royalty rate. So I actually made
You made a nice chunk of change.
I was comfortable.
Yeah, and now it's been re-released, and you're going to make another nice little chunk of change here in the 25th anniversary edition.
Yes,
before we go here...
This is my union, the Writers Guild of America, God bless them.
Before we go here, Janet Leigh said that after doing Psycho, she never took a shower again. How are you about going into the water after writing, making, and seeing Jaws?
I'm okay with it, but I never liked the water much to begin with.
But I
will swim in deep water. I might not, go to a Florida beach to do it.
Don't want to go south of Daytona to New Smyrna Beach, no.
I think I'd be happier in Long Island Sound or the Great Lakes. I think swimming off Chicago's pier would be...
Yeah. And you probably don't want to do a lot of swimming in the Mississippi here in St. Louis. Stay away. Those mud sharks will get you.
Well, I remember I was when I was a young man, I was stationed in the Army at Fort Leonard Wood.
Uh-huh.
And St. Louis was my refuge, my escape.
So you know this town well. Now, by the way, are there any actual sharks in the movie? I know Bruce the shark, the mechanical shark, is the great white. Are there real sharks in there?
Yeah, they were filmed in Australia by the underwater diving camera team of Ron and Valerie Taylor, who also filmed Blue Water, White Death,
mm-hmm.
which is the shark documentary that Peter Benchley did, independent of us.
And I guess the shark hanging on the dock that day, the fishermen come back and they catch this big shark.
That was a real shark, and it smelled like a real shark.
I didn't even think of that. You're filming all day long. That fish has got to stink by the afternoon.
Oh, but it was up. It was hanging there for 3 days. By the third day, there was this like huge gap in the crowd downwind of the shark, and the ADs would have to herd everybody because theoretically we're in a circle around the shark.
Yeah.
But the downwind section was just intolerable. It was nip and tuck if we would finish filming the scene before the shark just dissolved in a puddle of noxious goo.
Oh, man.
Sharks, for the interested fans out there, sharks are a very simple protein. They don't have any skeletons. They just have a cartilage. So being a very simple protein, they break down very easily. Tuna will hang up there for a week or two because it's a big, sturdy fish.
Mm-hmm.
The shark is just simple, basic, primordial protein.
Stinking fish.
And it becomes one big stinking fish very quickly.
Well, you would know. You were there. And I thank you for your time today. I enjoyed reading it 25 years ago and looking through it again. I'm getting all these memories of one of my all-time favorites. I think most Americans list this in the top 10 movies of all time. And you certainly should be proud of it. It's called The Jaws Log, the 25th Anniversary Edition. Carl Gottlieb, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me. And the book's in the bookstores now. So
not only that, it's the book of the week on my website, harrisonline.com, so my listeners can click and buy it simply right through there.
Yeah. Oh, and jawslog.com, as long as we're, let's plug our .coms.
Absolutely.
jawslog.com.
Great. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks so much, Paul. I really appreciate the talk.
Carl Gottlieb, the Jaws Log 25th Anniversary Edition. Wow, what a movie. And what stories, too. And we didn't even touch on 80% of what he's got in the book here. Great stuff. This is the Big 550 KTRS. More of the Paul Harris Show after this.